Welcome to the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of August the 1st, 2016. This week, the cost of doing the right thing. This week, we're going to take a look at information related to certain developments. This is brought to you, as always, by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated. Key things we're going to look at this week is we're going to discover that in the Ninth Circuit took a look at what accounts related to an online gambling site were considered to be reportable under the FBAR reporting and what sites are not. We're also going to take a look at the fact that the IRS this week formally adopted regulations that are going to reduce the paperwork requirements when employees make Section 83B elections. So when that'll help us in that regard. We have the IRS taking a look at who potentially get the Section 199 deduction when a professional sports league contracts with a network for broadcast of the games. And we'll look at that background. We also will discover that paying off a laid off employee's final payroll checks exposed a CEO to the trust fund penalty, the moral of which is nice guys get to pay the bills. And we'll also take a look at the draft of the expanded preparer due diligence forms that are going to be required next year since Congress in the PATH Act added two more benefits for which preparers can be penalized $510 unless the preparer has demonstrated that they exercise due diligence in the handling of the matter in question. So we're going to take a look at that and kind of decide what that impacts on what that impact that'll have on your practice for the coming year. Well, we are here sitting here in the beginning of August, and I wanted to point out for those of you in Arizona, I'm going to be teaching a course coming up on the 22nd of August that deals with tax practice in general. Now, this qualifies both for the 4 hours of Arizona ethics, so hey, there's good news. You get that in there. And we'll talk about 8 hours. We'll talk as part of this practice, too, about the regulations and standards that apply to tax practice and maybe what sort of steps you should be taking to have a quality tax practice of your own, what sort of things are involved, what sort of steps you should be taking. So I want to take a look at all those issues. So if you're interested in that type of topic, be sure to sign up here on the 22nd of August for the Arizona basically course. It's titled Ethics and Quality Control in Tax Practice. We'll talk a lot about tax practice. And by the way, it's an 8-hour session, but it'll give you the idea, give you the ability to use that in Arizona for 4 hours of ethics. Note, most states outside of Arizona, it's not going to qualify. If the state has specific requirements for ethics, be very careful whenever you sign up for an ethics course to verify if your state has specific requirements like Arizona does, that whatever ethics course you sign up with actually qualifies for ethics credit. It's usually a bad thing to discover that, in fact, hey, you don't qualify for ethics because you know what? Basically, sorry, guys, you know, your course has to have certain other structures, and basically you don't. So let's go on to our first development this week. We're going to start out here talking about the case of United States versus Hom, 118 AFR 2nd, paragraph 2016-5057. This is a Ninth Circuit case issued on July the 21st. In this particular case, the taxpayer was involved in online gambling. So that's fine. You know, the taxpayer gambles online. That's great. But the taxpayer, the question became, did the taxpayer have to report, because he did quite a bit of gambling online, did he have to file an FBAR report for those purposes for doing that? And that gets to be an interesting problem because obviously a failure to do so can be very costly. In this case, the taxpayer really had three different accounts. There are three different structures here. He had accounts with two online gambling sites. And he had an account with an organization or with an entity that served to transfer funds from his U.S. bank to the offshore gambling sites. Because of U.S. law, quite a few U.S. banks, in fact, virtually all U.S. banks, are not going to directly transfer to an online gambling site located offshore because they could be deemed to be in violation of federal law by doing so. So the question became, this person was keeping balances in excess of 10 grand, you know, in excess of their limitations on these accounts because he had a lot of gambling. The question became, could he be penalized for failing to do so? The total penalties in this case, because he had only one of the accounts in one of the years and he had three accounts in the second year. So we're looking at a $40,000 penalty. And the IRS said, wait, all three of those count. All three of those accounts count as a financial institution account offshore. The Ninth Circuit, however, now the district court agreed with the IRS and said, sorry, you know, you owe $40,000. The Ninth Circuit, however, took a slightly different approach. The Ninth Circuit did not believe that the actual gambling sites qualified as financial institutions. They took a look at the regulations that are found. And again, because this is not part of the IRC, what we end up with is our regulations are in Title 31 of the U.S. Code, Section basically you're going to find there in those regulations. So we're under 31 United States Code, essentially, Section 103.11W5. How's that for a background of these regulations? The Ninth Circuit looked at that, and they decided that, in fact, the only one was the licensed sender of money or person who engages in the business of transmissions of funds was the organization that took the money from, in this case, Wells Fargo, and then would turn around and transfer it to the online gambling sites. However, the Ninth Circuit did not find, that the gambling sites themselves qualified as banking institutions, even though the district court did. In the U.S. government spent a lot of time on a case from the Fourth Circuit, United States versus Clines, specifically saying that any institution that receives and disperses funds at the taxpayer's direction is a financial institution. The Ninth Circuit differentiated the Clines case. It said not every organization that receives money and then sends money back potentially to you is considered that, because that's really all these things did. They received money from home and then they sent the money back to home. They didn't really transfer money to any other organization. The Ninth Circuit found that that was not a financial institution. Now, a couple of takeaways from this case. Number one, please realize this is not a reported Ninth Circuit decision. As such, it's not considered precedential in the Ninth Circuit, so it's even a little bit dangerous to rely upon it here. But it does give you an analysis of how these things could be analyzed. What I would suggest is this is not something to say, you know what, Joe, you don't have to report your online poker sites. It's probably safest to report those because the IRS is probably still going to claim that they should have been reported. And frankly, you know, there's little downside of reporting them in this standpoint to the IRS, the theory would go, because you're going to report the transfer site, which you're almost certainly going to have to. So we're going to know kind of where to go follow the money. Secondly, it also means that the IRS can't use this wedge to try to, you know, force you to pay an extra penalty. And let's be honest, if your client is actually doesn't want to admit this and isn't reporting the income from these sites, they've got huge problems anyway. So the reality is that this is more a protective than a planning case. And be very careful, because you're looking here too at, always when dealing with these offshore accounts, we're looking at potential evasion issues if the taxpayer is misusing them. And that's a criminal situation for which, you know, those who are not licensed members of the bar have no protection whatsoever. In essence, anything your client tells you can essentially become Exhibit A against them in a criminal trial. So be very, very careful dealing with this, but does tell us a little more information about the definition. The other downside is, since it was all decided based on the regulation, if the IRS wants to reverse this, all Treasury has to do is change the regulation. If they change the regulation, then suddenly we don't have a problem. You know, they don't have the problem. Next up, the IRS took a step this year to do something they had told us they were planning to do last year. They issued proposed regulations. This is Treasury Decision 9779, issued on July 24th, and it deals with the fact that no longer will employees, or technically service providers, have to attach a Section 83B election to their tax return. Under the prior rules, what had to happen, and some of the, you know, this is still true, if you're given restricted stock, that's usually where this comes in. So you're given an interest in the company, your employer, but there are restrictions that say you've got to stay here for 5 years or you forfeit the stock. So if you don't work for 5 years, the stock's forfeited. Well, the provision that says that, that's considered to be a restriction that would eventually lapse. Under the normal rules of Section 83B, we pay no tax when we're granted those shares because we don't really own them. But that means 5 years from now, when we receive those shares, you know, when the restrictions lapse and we now can do what we want with those shares, at that point, we have to pick up the entire value at that date as ordinary income. In many cases, the reason why we went to work for these people is because we feel that, like, it's a startup organization, we feel it's going to be far more valuable. That's why we took the stock. So the problem is, if we wait 5 years, we may have gone from paying tax on $3,000 to suddenly paying tax on $3 million. While had we made an A3B election, we would only pay tax on the $3,000. Then we later go to sell the stock. We could get long-term capital gains because our holding period would go back to that first day. But to do so, you've got to notify the service recipient within 30 days of receipt, give them a signed election, send the election to the IRS, and then the old rule said you had to attach an election to your tax return. Now, under the new rules, we no longer have to do that. In fact, last year, the IRS told us for anything done before January 1st, 2015, they issued these as proposed regs. We didn't have to attach that any longer because it was complicating electronic filing. Now the IRS has finalized those regulations. They made no changes. Technically, these rules apply to anything received after January 1st, 2016, but because of last year's proposed regulations, for all practical purposes, they also apply to any 2015 returns you still have on extension that you haven't filed yet. So effectively, we get rid of having to attach 83B elections to the return. You still need to do all the other steps you had to do to have a valid 83B election. That did not change under these rules. So you want to be careful and make sure that you don't cause a problem there. Next up, we have Chief Counsel Advice 2016-30015 issued on July 22nd, 2016. This became an issue where a sports league entered into a contract with a network to broadcast their games. And it would appear from the fact that this memo came up that the sports league wanted to claim a Section 199 deduction for game production costs, claiming that the network was producing these under contract for the league. Production of films, and this is considered a film despite its despite the fact it's a live broadcast, can qualify for the Section 199 deduction. The catch is, though, as always, only one entity can get that deduction. Here, of course, the sports league in question believes it should get that right. However, the IRS decided in this case, looking at the facts of the contract that they had with the network, that in fact, this was actually a production of the network. They point out that the network needed to fill time on its broadcast. It was filling time in the schedule. The network controlled all aspects. They provided the announcers. They did all the graphics. They did everything. About all the league did was had vague supervisory, vague ability to probably, veto a few issues and then also put the game on. But the network had control of everything else. So the IRS determined in this case, at least the national office did, that the network and not the league was the actual producer of this broadcast. It was not being produced under a contract with a third party to produce something for you, but rather was being done as part of the network's whole job of just filling their broadcast schedule. Now, this can be interesting and useful to you, so therefore the league could not get the 199 deduction. This can be useful for you because many cases and many companies these days are paying for production to be done on programs. Maybe they're doing videos because they're putting things on YouTube. Maybe they're doing videos because they're having to do, maybe they hire out to do commercial work for themselves. So they're putting commercials on television. That was the old style. But there's a lot of people putting videos on the internet and paying production companies to handle the production of those videos. You want to take a look and notice the differences between what you're doing, what the network's doing. I think a key difference here is the network actually had a broadcast schedule to fill. It was not the league trying to fill up their website. As such, since the network had a broadcast schedule to fill, it was the network that really was producing things for use, and they just went and found a sports team to go televise and contracted with them to essentially put teams on the field for them. So this will be very different, I think, if you're looking at producing where you're hiring a third-party production company to produce a video that you're going to post, let's say, on YouTube, because you want to make that available to your customers. I think that'll be a very different scenario. And therefore, you should be aware that you want to take a look at this and differentiate yourself. If you do have a situation where you are contracting with a broadcaster who is going to broadcast the video, expect the IRS to fall back on this particular ruling and claim, in that case, sorry, guys, you don't qualify. You don't qualify for Section 199. It is the network or the television station that can get the deduction because they're the ones who are actually involved in production of a broadcast for their use. You're just providing some talent or some other basis for this. So really, you're the party that's being contracted from, and you don't get this. So we don't need to go into that. If we do need to go into it, then we look at who has the rights and who basically has the, you know, the benefits and burdens of ownership becomes the standard. If we do decide it's a contracted option, there you've got to show that you have the benefits and burdens of ownership. And that ends up looking at a longer view of how this works, a little more involved as to who gets stuck with what. Next up, we have a case here, which I guess goes down to nice guys finish last. It's not quite that way, but it comes awfully close. This is Arriondo versus United States, a case from United States District Court for the Southern District of Texas. And it was case number 414-CV02734. The case was decided on July the 26th. And the issue in this case was that Mr. Arriondo had been hired as the CEO, taking over as the CEO for this subsidiary after the another CEO who had owned shares of stock in the company basically left and sold out. The opinion doesn't tell us for sure, but we do discover at one point that this company is now owned by an ESOP. So it may very well be that the old owner was effectively, the old CEO was essentially the owner who sold out to the ESOP. Again, we don't know that in this case, but it's a very plausible reason why the old CEO had ownership and the new CEO doesn't, because it's wholly owned by us by now an ESOP. He discovered, unfortunately, a couple of things came up. First, the state of Texas sent a notice of levy for unpaid excise taxes. Turned out they hadn't been paying their sales taxes to the state of Texas. So he discovered this issue and, you know, he got in contact with his controller and she told him, oh, yeah. Don't worry about that. We're taking care of it. We've been tight on money. And he knew they were tight on money. And yeah, those were unpaid, but we're entering into an agreement with the state of Texas and we won't have a problem there. Okay. So Mr. Arriondo took a word of his controller and he also didn't look into any other taxes that might have been unpaid. Now, a little bit later, it turns out that in addition to not paying the state of Texas for sales taxes, the controller also stopped paying to keep the doors open, the IRS payroll taxes, and so the trust funds were not deposited. There were two quarters in question. The controller signed the first quarter payroll reports for the year, and they reflected that essentially there was a large chunk of unpaid taxes. In the second quarter, they paid no taxes, you know, none of the taxes, none of the deposits got made. She prepared a 941 in the second quarter that showed the entire balance unpaid, but she never signed that form and she resigned before it was filed. Now, at this point, they bring in a new controller. The new controller walks in and tells Mr. CEO, I need to talk with you. He takes a look at what's been going on and discovers that there's essentially six figures of unpaid payroll taxes out there. And Mr. Arriondo hadn't been aware of this fact. So he understands that given how tight they are for money right now, he knew they're tight. He looks at this and it's a clearly hopeless situation. They don't have the money to pay off the liabilities and keep operating. So he decides, well, our only hope here is to go for bankruptcy. Well, he actually decided there were two hopes, which kind of got him in trouble. First, he decided maybe we could finish up this one job we already agreed to do. And if we did that, we'd get the money to pay the payroll taxes. So he sent off a $5,000 deposit to a supplier that he hoped would get them to deliver the materials to him that would enable them to finish the job. Unfortunately, what the supplier did was just applied it to the unpaid bills they already had. The supplier wasn't an idiot and, you know, saw what was probably going to be happening. So effectively, they didn't get that money, didn't complete the job. He also contacted bankruptcy counsel and he laid off virtually all the employees now. Now, what happens at this point was he paid the laid off employees after he discovered there were unpaid payroll taxes. He went ahead and paid them for their work. He also took checks for his own work because the bankruptcy attorney told him since he wasn't an owner, he was considered an employee who was eligible to be paid under bankruptcy law. Totally correct. Under bankruptcy law, the problem comes with the trust fund penalty. The IRS asserted that Mr. Arriondo owed the unpaid trust fund taxes. Now, there's a good chance that what's happening here is, because obviously there were more than one bad actor and the controller appears to be somebody who really knew what was happening and essentially caused the problem. But Mr. Arriondo had loaned the company money to make payrolls in the past. unfortunately, this looks like the IRS is going after, because you go after multiple people for trust funds. They found somebody with deep pockets. They're going after him. They're trying to get this done. Now, he, of course, said, no, it wasn't willful. Basically, we went to shut down. We closed up the business. Didn't I do everything right? Problem is, the court found, no, he didn't. There were funds on deposit when Mr. Arredondo became aware that taxes weren't paid. The only thing he can do at that point to avoid the trust fund penalty, basically, was to take the money he had, apply it to trust funds. Does that mean employees don't get paid? Well, tough luck. Employees don't get paid. Does that mean that we're never going to get that job? Yeah, it means don't get that job because you can't make the deposit. It means, what about the bankruptcy attorney's counsel? Fine, but irrelevant for this point. We're not talking about whether bankruptcy law allows you to be paid. We're talking about whether the trust fund penalty applies because you allowed money to be paid. If he didn't have control over paying funds, then yes, he clearly could have been paid under bankruptcy law, and then somebody else would be on the hook. But in this case, he was aware of it. The issue becomes, this is very much a case of, as we said, apparent. I would believe Mr. Arredondo is trying to do the right thing. He's trying to pay the employees for the work they did. Tough luck was it was held against him. The court also noted that there was another problem. As soon as he became aware there were unpaid taxes to the state of Texas and he knew they were in financial difficulty, he really should have made inquiries about whether there were payroll taxes that were being paid as well. He never did that. He trusted the controller. Unfortunately, trusting the controller that was under his supervision is not something that goes over well either. So at the end of the day, Mr. Arredondo, probably a very nice guy, probably somebody who really tried to do the right thing, he's going to end up paying a whole bunch of trust fund taxes because he got caught being somebody who apparently could pay and he allowed payments to be made to other people, like employees, while he knew there were taxes outstanding to the IRS. Finally, we have a draft of the expanded due diligence form that was released by the IRS. The form 8867 for 2016 has been released on July 27th. We have a copy of this form in our PDF for this week. So if you download the PDF, you'll get it. Last year, Congress expanded the due diligence rules. So now, not only do we have to go ahead and fill out Form 8867 if we find a client is claiming an income tax credit, we now have to fill it out if a client's claiming the child tax credit or the advance, basically the extra child credit, the refundable version or the regular version, either one, or it's claiming the American Opportunity Tax Credit. Now, the way the form works, on page one of the form, you'll notice this year we have three columns, one column for each of the credits that apply, so you'll do it for each. Then on page two, we have specific due diligence questions for each one. What first one's for the earned income credit, questions that apply only for that. The second one is for the child tax credit. Now, what's important here is you're going to be asked a question. Did the child live with the taxpayer? And you need evidence of this fact. They say you got to make inquiries. You've got to explain to them the rules about what living with means most nights. And if they answer no, then you have to go see, was there a sign form going to be asked? Did you get an 8332 and have you attached it to this return? That's going to be a yes, no question. Similarly, for the American tax credit, did they provide substantiation like a 1098-T for it? Now, remember, this year, they let the schools off. They don't need to file that T this year. They don't need to. They can use billed, I should say, instead of paid. So you're going to need to say, did you get substantiation that allows you to say, I'm good with what they're claiming as a credit? Again, the failure to follow through on all these, as the IRS and the form notes, is there is a 510 penalty per violation for the preparer. So if you claim this credit and you cannot show that you had done all the work, and by the way, at the end of that form, they tell you exactly what you have to keep. And for basically until the statute runs on this return, you've got to keep a copy of the 8867, the worksheets that were filled out for any credits claim, copies of any taxpayer documents that you relied upon, and a record of questions you ask the taxpayer about this. So it's not enough just ask them in your interview. You need to document. So at the end of your interview, you need to document that you actually got this information from the client. And if it turns out, as sometimes does, you don't discover the issues there until later because, it turns out they actually qualified for it because, hey, they weren't income excluded out of it. Then you need to document when you make the phone call later that you actually got that information. Again, a failure here has a couple of problems. It can block them from claiming the credit in the future, so there's a liability issue there. And there's simply the problem of getting stuck with a bill for something that effectively, you know, you're going to be stuck with the $510 penalty. Not good. Now, we're coming up now. We're here at the beginning of August. We're in the middle of the dog days of summer. Your clients are probably on vacation. You can't get that information you need from them because they're not going to be back for 2 weeks. This is a perfect time to go looking at what your state societies are offering you for courses during this period. You can take a look at your state society's websites. There's lots of things being offered here in August. Go ahead and see if there's something there. You might as well get benefit out of this, right? Go ahead, relax, watch your courses, you know, be at your classes, take the courses. Really an interesting time. Go ahead and check your state society website to see what is being offered and what maybe you should be catching up on here before the clients get back in town and you're into that September 15th and October 15th rush to the final deadlines. This has been the current federal tax developments for the week of August 1st, 2016. Be sure to catch our daily updates at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. There you can download a PDF with all the articles on the topics we talked about this week. Also, you can send any questions or comments you have to Ed Zollers at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Ed Zollers. So you can find out all the information. You'll get a clue, too, if you do any of those about what we'll talk about next week. And be sure to join us next week when we talk about the developments that take place in the first week of August in the area of federal taxes.